They were fascinated with my life and my career and who I am and the work I do with women. And, you know, their eyes were just lit up with curiosity and interest and, you know, wanting to be make their own lives something, you know.
This is World Report for July 21st, 2008. World Report is an exploration of the anguish and the beauty of international events from a Canadian perspective. Three meetings loom large in this week's wave of events. The WTO negotiations in Geneva, meetings of the International Atomic Energy Agency and the Nuclear Suppliers Group, and the Pan-African Conference to End Impunity on Sexual and Gender-Based Violence. The latter is likely the most meaningful and therefore commands the most of our attention. I caught up with Neda Hyde just before she moved from Nelson to Victoria. She's been doing trauma work with women for 30 years and had just come back from a project in Africa. We'll hear the first part of that interview later in the show. But first, some of the context of the week. There never was much danger that anyone was taking the G8 all that seriously. The countries that had already failed to live up to their Kyoto commitments were posturing about climate change, promising aid that had already been promised before, sometimes more than once, and that was largely tied and therefore designed mainly to stimulate the economies of the donor nations, not the other way around. But leaders of the world's power economies are undeterred by simple folly. The World Trade Organization negotiations in Geneva this week faced significant hurdles due to the recent spike in food prices and the limited gains projected for developing countries, according to a statement issued by the Center for Economic and Policy Research this week. And that's just for openers. Most developing countries are net food importers. The recent increase in food prices has led some developing country governments to reconsider food security mechanisms such as tariffs, quotas, and domestic subsidies, which the WTO seeks to reduce. A number of countries have also imposed restrictions on exports in response to the food crisis. According to the co-director and economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Mark Weisbrot, in its first 13 years in existence, the WTO has failed to deliver development results for the vast majority of low- and middle-income countries. He goes on to say that new factors such as rising food prices and the international financial crisis, which originated in the U.S. housing market, have made governments even more skeptical of international commercial agreements designed by the rich countries, end quote. At the same time, collapse of the U.S. government-chartered finance companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is resulting in a reluctance on the part of commercial banks to lend to one another. For example, Carlyle Capital, the mortgage debt investment fund of the famous Carlyle Group, is the most recent to ask that lenders halt further liquidation of collateral worth as much as $16 billion. Ambrose Evans Pritchard, international business editor of The Telegraph, notes that foreign bondholders have begun to exercise a collective vote of no confidence in the devaluation policies of the U.S. government. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac underpin 60% of the $11 trillion market for U.S. home loans. Many who only months ago sought the privatization, deregulation, and liberalization of practically everything are now calling for emergency interventions by the Federal Reserve Bank and even the partial nationalization of the American banking system. Evans Pritchard believes that, quote, the twin crash in the dollar and U.S. agency debt reflects a broad exodus by global wealth managers afraid that America is spinning out of control, end quote. Tokyo's Nikkei index is crumbling. Asian, Mideast, and European investors stood aside at last week's auction of 10-year U.S. Treasury notes. It was a disaster, said Ray Atrill from ForecastWeb, and last week's Italian Treasury auction was also a flop. Evans Pritchard asks if this is the moment when America finally discovers the meaning of the Faustian pact it signed so blithely with Asian creditors. the U.S. has come to depend on $800 billion of inflows of cheap foreign capital each year to cover shopping bills, and the debtors are calling in the debt. As of June 2007, foreigners own just over $6 trillion in long-term U.S. debt, equal to 66% of the entire U.S. federal debt. The biggest holdings by country are Japan with $901 billion, China with $870 billion, the UK with $475 billion. Canada, which owns $106 billion, is 14th on that list. Meanwhile, the Chinese have quickened the pace of the appreciation of the yuan to choke off 8.7% inflation, and that is having the effect of slowing U.S. bond purchases. Meanwhile, India hasn't lost confidence in the U.S. This week, Indian negotiators will take the U.S.-India nuclear deal to both the IAEA and the Nuclear Suppliers Group. In a view from Sri Lanka in the Daily Mirror, Amin Izzaddin asks if the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh is bound to the burning bush. The answer seems to be yes. Izzaddin asks the right questions. Why is Washington going all out to help the nuclear program of a country which has not signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty? Compare U.S. policy toward India with its policy toward Iran, which has signed the Nonproliferation Treaty. The U.S. is threatening Iran with military action if Tehran doesn't abandon its uranium enrichment program. On the other hand, it rewards India, a country which possesses nuclear weapons, with U.S. technical and financial assistance. Why did the Bush administration say no when Pakistan made a request that a similar agreement be signed with Islamabad, too? Security and terrorism expert Bahu Kutumbi Rahman of the South Asia Analysis Group answers these questions. Muslim chat groups on the internet have noted that not only the leftist parties, but even the Indian political class as a whole and the Indian elite have maintained a silence over the recent public execution of two Uyghurs, the arrest of about 80 others, and the forcible closure of 40 mosques by the Chinese. They have noted the energetic manner in which the Indian public opinion reacted to the repression of the Tibetans, but maintained a discreet silence on the repression of Muslims. As the date, July 22, 2008, for the vote of confidence from the Indian Parliament in the Manmohan Singh government nears, and as the possibility of an early election looms, a question often debated is the attitude of the Indian Muslims to the Indo-U.S. nuclear deal. Do they regard it as anti-Muslim because of the perceived anti-Muslim policies of the administration of President George Bush? That is the question which has been raised again and again by the critics of the deal and of Prime Minister Dr. Manmohan Singh. Indications are that the Singh government will take their request for special measures to permit the deal to both the IAEA and the Nuclear Suppliers Group this week. A Pan-African conference that aims to end impunity on sexual and gender-based violence begins today in Nairobi, Kenya. I'll have more about that conference, along with part two of my interview with Neda Hyde, next week. Neda Hyde is a psychologist with a background in nursing. She's been doing trauma work with women for the last 30 years. For the last 15 years, she worked in Nelson, mostly around issues of sexual abuse. During the winter of 2007, she was in Lesotho on a project sponsored by the Help Lesotho Foundation. I talked to her in our Nelson studios. You went to Lesotho as a clinical psychologist to do what?
I was invited by the Institute on Governance in Ottawa in conjunction with a Canadian charitable organization called Help Lesotho to go as a gender equity specialist to Lesotho. So I went last winter for 6 weeks to Lesotho and worked there doing work with principally with adolescent girls and women to help them to learn about their rights as women in a culture that's an extremely male-dominated and sexually violent culture. The gender-based violence against women there is breathtaking. It's way beyond what we experience in our culture.
I'm curious to explore just a little bit about. I hear you saying that you were invited. How did that come about? How did they know about you?
They knew about me because of a radio program, in which I wasn't on it. But I heard Sheila Rogers one morning as I was leaving the gym here, actually, and she was interviewing Dr. Peg Herbert and Sister Alice, who were the two founders of this organization, Help Lesotho. And Peg Herbert was talking about this new organization and how Sister Alice had been a student of hers. Sister Alice is from Lesotho. She's a Roman Catholic nun who came to Ottawa to do graduate work. She was supported by her convent, the Sisters of Charity, and she was in Peg Herbert's graduate class at the University of Ottawa, and was talking about and writing about in her master's thesis the terrible difficulties in Lesotho for children and young people to get education. There's no money. There are fees for high school. There are fees for uniforms, and every student has to wear a uniform. There are fees for books. And so most people there have trouble finding enough money to even eat once a day, let alone three times a day. So the fees were astronomical for most families, and what a terrible problem this was. So Peg Herbert got very involved and went over to Lesotho with Sister Alice and ended up starting this fantastic organization, and now has been there. She still is in Ottawa, but there is an office in Lesotho, and has done tremendous things for educational programs there. And one of the things that has happened that I got involved with was a child sponsorship program for $465 Canadian a year. Anyone can support a particular child to go to high school, and I thought that that was a fantastic thing to do. So my partner, Helga Jacobson, who is an anthropologist and taught at UBC for many, many years, is, of course, very keen on education, and as am I. And so we sponsored a girl to send her through high school. And then the next year, another girl, and the next year, another girl. So we have three girls now that we are putting through high school there.
And this is done through the Help Lesotho organization?
It's done through their organization. They have a tremendous website. You can just Google Help Lesotho, and it's spelled L-E-S-O-T-H-O.
Good.
Yes. And, you know, for lots of us as Canadians, $465 doesn't break the bank, and they've even got it divided down. You can pay $37.75 a month if that's more workable, and it makes the difference between life and death for girls in Lesotho, and that really is not being overly dramatic. It just is the way things are there.
Has anything changed with the fees? I know Kenya has had a different experience with fees, that the fees were imposed to some extent by their structural adjustment programs through the IMF and the World Bank, and they have eliminated the fees and brought hundreds of thousands of kids into school who simply couldn't afford to even think about going
yes.
to school because of the fees.
Oh, well, at the present time in Lesotho, my understanding is that primary school is now available to students who can get themselves there, which in itself is a challenge, mm-hmm. because Lesotho is a very beautiful and high mountain country. So students have long distances to travel every day, you know, over the mountains to get to wherever the nearest primary school is. But still, there isn't much support yet available for high school. Some AIDS orphans, double orphans as they're called, which means that they've lost both parents to AIDS, are supported by the government. But, you know, it's a process to get the money and to get accepted. So there still are many, many students who are sitting at home and very upset, as you know, we can imagine how that would be for our own students here who love school and who've done great in school, and after grade 7 there's nothing.
Right. And what is a common livelihood in Lesotho?
The country is often it's farming and herding. So there are, and you know, so the income is not great. There's not much industry there, and there's still very little infrastructure. So you know, for instance, the town that the Help Lesotho office is in has very few overhead lights at night, even, or very few landline telephones. People who have telephones have cell phones. That's mostly what's available. And, you know, there are shopkeepers. There's, in that town, there's one hospital, so there are some nurses, very few doctors. Most people who are doctors leave the country to seek employment someplace that where they can make more money or not be so overwhelmed by the numbers of patients to care for. So it's very difficult.
I'm torn between wanting to ask you more about the country and wanting to ask you about the project that you were on. Let's talk about the project that you, the work that you did there for a little while.
Yes. So I ran groups for adolescent girls.
These were girls past grade 7, presumably.
They were.
Right?
These were girls who were in high school, supported by Help Lesotho to go to high school. And they were living in a hostel that was run by the Anglican Church. Lesotho is a Christian country, and so a lot of the schools are either Anglican or Roman Catholic. Those are the main religious groups there.
What was the colonial country, the colonial power? Was that Britain?
There wasn't a colonial power there. It's quite different than lots of African countries. And I might just say it's a very small country. It only has 2 million people, or maybe just a little bit over 2 million. And it's entirely surrounded by South Africa.
Uh-huh. It's an enclave.
Yes, it really is. So, and as I said before, it's very, very beautiful. But one of the problems there now is that it's got a huge drought that's been going on for the last 5 or 6 years. And I keep hearing from people there who I email that, you know, it's spring and they still haven't had any rain. So that, of course, means that people, I know I'll get back to the question about the project,
right.
But just to fill in just a little bit about the country, people grow their own gardens. That's a lot of what people who have very low incomes can do to feed themselves. And, of course, in times of drought, you know, they don't have the money, the resources, nothing to get irrigation systems, nothing fancy like that. So if there isn't rain, there isn't food. And so there's been big problems there because of that. But to get back to the project, one of the things that I did in this group was because the country has been very slow to, as so many other places, to really recognize women as equal members of the culture and the society. In fact, I think it was only in 2003 that women were legally given equal rights under the law. And of course, common practice is very slow to follow on what is legal.
Is it unusual for girls to get to the level of high school?
It is unusual for girls. So that's one of the reasons that Help Lesotho has focused on providing tuition for girls to go to high school to try to right some of these wrongs that have happened over the years. And so I met with the girls and I talked to them about the legitimacy of equality and what equality looks like. you know, the necessity to be able to stand up and speak out for one's own rights. And then because there's so much sexual violence, to talk to girls about how to say no to sexual advances that are unwanted from boys, including rape, which is very common there. And the girls have grown up in families, of course, where they've seen their fathers batter their mothers. In the 6 weeks that I was there, I heard of two women who'd been killed by their husbands, just in that small period of time. And these were women who were relatives of people I worked with. So that was a very, very just small group of what is going on there.
Are these traditional behaviors, or are they behaviors that are associated with some kind of urbanization or some other kind of alienation?
Their behaviors, that's a good question. Over the years, and less so now, but up until, I would say, 10 or 15 years ago, a lot of the men in Lesotho found work in the South African mines. So they left the family to get employment, mm-hmm. and often were away for a year, 2 years at a time. So that makes for a very disenfranchised family group. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, they would come home from time to time and bring some money to their family. But, you know, often they were seeing prostitutes or other women while they were away. And often they would come home, and whether or not the wife had had any other relationship while they were gone, there often was that accusation. Mm-hmm. And they also brought HIV/AIDS home with them. And so the rate of infection in Lesotho, it's very high. It's the third highest rate of infection in the world there. So it's a tremendous problem. One quarter of all people in Lesotho is HIV positive. And that's a staggering statistic.
That is huge.
Yeah. So it was very important to talk to the girls about sexual matters, because they said that their parents, and often it was the mother, if they even had parents still, if the parents hadn't already died, but in families there, sexual matters are not talked about openly. So they had no way really to get information. And as big a problem as HIV/AIDS is, it's a shameful secret. Nobody talks about it. It's unreal, you know, to be in a place where it's going on all the time. People are getting sick all the time. Saturday is funeral day. There are cars honking on the main street as the funerals go by all day long, the processions of funerals. And nobody says, so-and-so died of AIDS. They always say, oh, he was sick, he died. And that's all that gets said.
So it's something more than just a fear of stigmatization. If that's the case, I mean, if the person is dead, then there's nothing much more that you can do to them.
No,
I suppose,
except that people don't want anybody else to know what their father or mother died of, because, of course, it gets so intimately linked with sex. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are babies born that are HIV positive. If the mother is HIV positive and hasn't been able to either get tested and know that, or if she knows it, even to ask for treatment is very stigmatizing.
Hmm. So what happens if somebody, if it's found out that someone is HIV positive?
Well, they're often shunned. And there, of course, are some very brave souls who are trying to change that. I saw one young man there who had a bright red T-shirt on that had written in, I think it was white letters across it, HIV positive. And I thought, how courageous of him. And I saw a few other people who came from some Christian organization in which they were wearing HIV positive t-shirts, and on the back they had some kind of saying from their church that was really supporting the necessity of people speaking out, getting tested, and knowing their status. So I talked to the girls in the groups about all of these things. And of course, when everybody hears about, it's a small world there, you know, so they all hear about things that are happening around them. But unless there's somebody who really almost gives them permission to speak and encourages them to speak, it's still hidden within that cloak of secrecy and shame. So that was a big part of what I did. Not to mention role modeling, what it's like to be a woman in the world. You know, I came halfway around the world from this other country, Canada, mm-hmm. you know, to spend time with them, and I really cared about them, and I think that was fantastic role modeling for them because they were fascinated with my life and my career and who I am and the work I do with women. And, you know, their eyes were just lit up with curiosity and interest and, you know, wanting to make their own lives something, you know. And that was tremendous for me to be able to be a part of.
Uh-huh. That's it for World Report today. This morning's show will be rebroadcast this evening at 6. The World Report website and blog is at worldreport.cjly.net. You can listen to a copy of this broadcast, or subscribe to a podcast, or listen to just one show at that same website where several options are on offer. Of course, our preference is that you get your podcast from the KCR site. A more complete archive is available at the Radio for All site, and if you have client-side software on your machine, podcasts of this show are also available from iTunes. You can leave a comment about any of the stories on the website or send email directly to earthling@cjly.net. Send surface mail to Box 767, Nelson, Canada, V1L, 5R4, Attention World Report. If you're listening in the morning, stay tuned for KCR Stories with Terry Brennan and Brigida Hoos. If you're listening in the evening, the Bioneers will be coming up right after the station break. Thanks to the band Married to Music for the theme music played at the top of the show. That's from their vinyl album, Miracles. Thanks to Sidewinders Coffee Company for their continued sponsorship of the World Report Question of the Week. And thanks to Mike Cannon in Wausau, Wisconsin, Guy LaPointe of the Crow Healing Network, and Laura Savinkoff at the Boundary Peace Initiative. I'm Jim Terrell at World Report for Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. Thanks for listening.